Welcome to the Federal Societies Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Societies Corporation Securities and Antitrust and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, April 26, 2018, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Societies teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we are hosting a discussion on the struggle to rein in shareholder activism. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Jason Levine, a litigation partner at Vinson & Elkins, as well as Lawrence L. Baum, co-head and chief litigator of the shareholder activism practice at Vinson & Elkins. After hearing from our speakers, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Jason, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Micah, and thank you, everyone, for participating today. Lawrence and I are going to speak about the phenomenon of shareholder activism. We've divided the presentation into two parts. First, Lawrence will provide an overview of what activism is, its prevalence, its impact, and at least at a high level, provide some insights into what corporations may be able to do to protect themselves from activist attacks. And then second, I will talk about pending and proposed legal reforms intended to address or deal with shareholder activism and offer some thoughts about what appear to be the likelihood of passage and effectiveness of those reforms. So with that, Lawrence, please take it away for the first part of our talk.
Thank you, Jason, and thank you to all the members for having us. And looking forward to presenting and hopefully some robust Q&A at the end. As Jason said, I'm a partner with Vinson & Elkins. I'm one of the co-heads of our shareholder activism practice. We have the largest practice of this kind in the country, about 30 lawyers deep, covering a range of disciplines from corporate to litigation to tax, exec comp, labor and employment, et cetera. Our group has topped the league tables for shareholder activism defense for the last two calendar years and the first quarter of this year and counting. We are agnostic to the size of the company we represent. We represent companies that are microcaps all the way up to mega caps, and we're also industry agnostic, covering a very wide spectrum of industries, all the way from tech companies to pharmaceutical companies to industrial manufacturing and energy companies. So that's a bit about our group. I grew up as a securities litigator the first 9 years of my career. The last three plus years, I've been doing activism exclusively. I only see courtrooms in the context of shareholder activism, and there are plenty of reasons why shareholder activism campaigns end up in courtrooms. Over the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to cover a few topics. The first topic will be just a quick intro into the key players and themes and jargon that's used in the shareholder activism realm. Then I'll discuss briefly recent trends in shareholder activism. And then time permitting, I'll go over, as Jason said, at a very high level, a few suggestions on how we would recommend companies and advisors to companies think about how to best prepare for the continuing rising tide of shareholder activism in the United States. So there are different types of shareholder activism. Generally, the main type of shareholder activism is what we call economic activism, which is where a shareholder seeks to get the company sold or seeks to get the company to pay a dividend, repurchase stock, do M&A, not do M&A, so on and so forth. But there are other main themes that come up in shareholder activism campaigns for economic causes, and those are social activist causes and governance causes. Social activism causes are ones where activists also seek to compel companies to promote social, political, economic, or environmental change. And governance activism is where activists call on the company to implement so-called best practices related to corporate governance, proxy access, repeal a poison pill, declassify a board, promote gender and ethnic diversity, so on and so forth. Economic activism, in our view, is the main thrust of the vast majority of shareholder activism campaigns, but companies that are not in front of the curve on social and governance activism issues have low-hanging fruit for activists to poke at in the context of their economic activism campaign. So none of these campaign themes exclude each other. So what is shareholder activism? At its core, it's an election contest, right? Just like we have different election cycles in the United States, where voters choose one slate over another. That's exactly what happens with public companies. A board of directors essentially runs a public company in the United States, and typically the board of directors, or the whole board of directors, or a subset of the board of directors, is up for election every single year. And there's a window of time before the shareholder meeting where elections take place, where shareholder activists can make nominations to put their own slate up against the slate of directors that are incumbent at the company. And it's just like a political campaign. There's mudslinging. There are nasty ads taken out in newspapers. There are press releases that cross the wire that are nasty. There sometimes are nasty ads taken out on television as well. So there's very little difference between those two concepts. At the end of the day, it's a shareholder who's looking to get his or her or its own slate of directors on a board to effectuate those activism themes that I just discussed, economic activism, social activism, or governance activism. Just very briefly, for those on the phone who have seen the movie or who are old enough to have appreciated the context of the movie, the movie Wall Street from the 80s is a good example of the typical corporate raider. That was the brand in the 80s. Hostile takeovers, leverage buyouts, green mail, liquidate the company. That brand has gone through a transformation now 30 plus years later. What was called the corporate raider of the 80s is now called shareholder activism. And what many of the same investors were doing in the 80s to make money in these companies, they're now doing by taking smaller stakes in a company and trumpeting the notion of increasing value for all shareholders instead of enriching just one party. And it's resonated. There are many celebrity activists out there, Carl Icahn, Paul Singer from Elliott Management, Keith Meister from Corvex, Jeff Smith from Starboard. There are the marquee names that are out there. Of course, we're up against them every single proxy season, but there are hundreds of other activists out there attacking public companies in the U.S. These include funds with small amounts of money under management. They include now private equity funds. They include family offices. They include former CEOs and former company founders. They include long-term investors that are trying to effectuate change at companies who have been very stagnant. So we see a wide range of activists, all basically pursuing the same theme, which is sell the company or do something so that we can get a return maximized on our investment. So when we talk about economic activism, there really are three main tools in the activist toolkit. There's M&A activism, which is sell the company, spin off a portion of the company, a division of the company, spin off assets of the company, or activism against or for particular types of M&A transactions. There's balance sheet activism. When companies have a lot of cash on their balance sheet, it makes them a particularly easy target for an activist to say, like what happened in Apple a few years ago, pay a special dividend or buy back shares in the case of other companies. There's also operational activism. Most activists are not engaging in operational activism, but you see Carl Icahn and Jeff Smith of Starboard and Paul Singer of Elliott and Nelson Peltz try and do this from time to time. It's really roll up your sleeves, get on the board, sit on every single committee, and really figure out how management needs to be changed, you know, what businesses need to be eliminated or added, and what cost-cutting measures need to be pursued. Operational activism takes much longer than a traditional activist intends normally to hold on to their investment. It could take years for operational activism to realize value. Most activists, while they do a lot of research before making their first investment in a company, they're looking to get out within, say, 9 to 18 months of their investment, more often on the earlier side of that investment arc. So that's why you don't see that much operational activism. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there is a theme that you hear about in every single economic activism campaign, and that's corporate governance. So where you have a company that hasn't done a lot of M&A in recent years, they got a lot of cash on their balance sheet, and they've got a lot of costs they need to cut. If they've got a board with no ethnic or gender diversity, with long board tenures, with many takeover defenses in place, perhaps with other not best-in-class corporate governance issues, now they're really an activism target. And you'll hear just as much in a campaign for economic activism about corporate governance, because in the same way that you see politicians kissing babies in an election year because voters like to see it, shareholders like to hear about best practices in corporate governance. You hear activists and companies cloaking themselves in the banner of best corporate governance practices during these campaigns, because it's not just the mom and pop shareholders that like to hear about it. It's also the major institution, BlackRock, Vanguard, Fidelity, and the proxy advisory firms, who I'll explain who they are in a minute, ISS and Glass Lewis. They have a lot of sway over how election results come out, and corporate governance practices are very important to them. They're firm believers that corporate governance practices, when implemented in a best-in-class form, will always result in long-term value being maximized for a company and its shareholders. So in the past 15 years, shareholder activism campaigns in the United States that are publicly reported have quadrupled. There were about 50 or so campaigns per year pre-2003 and before 2003. We're expecting this year to have over 300 campaigns. Now, these are publicly reported campaigns. There are a lot of campaigns that get resolved without a formal securities filing. If you add up the number of public and private campaigns each year, we're probably looking at about 400 campaigns, maybe 500. There are about 4,000 public companies in the United States, so we're talking about at least 10% of corporate America being targeted each year. Most companies that are getting targeted for activism campaigns in the U.S. Are sub $10 billion market cap range. So let's say large cap down to micro and nano cap. But we are seeing more activism at the much larger companies, for example, Procter & Gamble last year. GM is another example. However, not every activism campaign results in a proxy contest, which is a vote at the ballot box or nominations being made for directors at an annual meeting. A lot of campaigns settle before an activist actually nominates people to a board. We do see about 80% of nominations and potential proxy fights actually happening at the $1 billion and under range in the United States. It's because most larger companies stay away from the headline risk of having an open kimono in the court of public opinion in the middle of proxy season. They're quicker to settle in many instances. Procter & Gamble went to the ballot box. I mentioned ISS and Glass Lewis earlier. I should explain who they are. They play perhaps the most pivotal role in many shareholder activism campaigns. So ISS stands for Institutional Shareholder Services. Glass Lewis is Glass Lewis. They're proxy advisory firms. So what are proxy advisory firms? So the large financial institutions in the country, BlackRock, Vanguard, Fidelity, State Street, T. Rowe Price, so on and so forth, they are invested in virtually every single public company in the U.S. They get, therefore, thousands of proxy statements each year, and all those public campaigns that I mentioned, they have to figure out how to vote on those campaigns. Portfolio managers don't have the time to manage portfolios and read proxy statements and make decisions. And these institutions have set up governance departments to make voting decisions. But the governance departments at these large institutions are also overwhelmed. So they give way and they take cues from proxy advisory firms, Institutional Shareholder Services, ISS, and Glass Lewis. ISS and Glass Lewis take a look at every single contested campaign in a public company each year that's going to go to a vote at the ballot box and the annual meeting, and they make a recommendation after reading all of the statements by the activist and statements by the company and investor presentations about why each side should win. They take either phone calls or in-person meetings with the activist and the company, and they ultimately make a recommendation several weeks before a company's annual meeting where the election takes place. And these large institutions that I mentioned heavily rely on the determinations of ISS and Glass Lewis, which many times can sway up to 30-40% of a company's shareholder base, depending on its size. Sometimes the influence is de minimis in much smaller companies, but as you move up in market cap, you move up in ISS, Glass Lewis, and influence. They are in many ways more important than a judge, more important than the SEC, which oversees proxy contests like Hawks. They're in many ways more important than the portfolio manager that first made the investment in your company. So they're critical. And historically, ISS has not been company friendly. In recent years, they've been making recommendations more than 50% of the time, slightly more than 50% of the time, in favor of companies and against activists. Glass Lewis has a reputation for being more company friendly, about 60% of the time, sometimes even more. They're finding and recommending in favor of a company slate over an activist slate. So a lot of proxy fights end up not going the distance I mentioned earlier. They settle. They settle before they go to the ballot box. A lot of times they settle after ISS and Glass Lewis make recommendations. but a lot of times they settle even before then. So if an activist is losing by a wide margin, typically they'll pack up their bags and go home and maybe issue a press release taking a victory lap for all the good the company has done since they launched their campaign. But if an activist is winning, and ISS and Glass Lewis has recommended, and now, you know, the vast majority of the shareholder base is recommending, is swaying in favor of the activist. Sometimes on the defense side, I'll get a phone call from the activist lawyer, and they want to talk settlement. Now, they're about to get 3, 4, maybe a control slate on the board, but they're asking for a settlement, and it might seem counterintuitive. Take the victory at the ballot box and, you know, thump your chest and issue a press release and get great marketing for a hedge fund. Well, there are a few reasons why I get that phone call. Number one, the activist realizes that it and its candidates for the board are now going to need to start mending fences. In the aftermath of a nasty campaign, you now got to break bread with the people that you've been spitting at for sometimes many months, sometimes many years. Settlement is a good way to achieve that objective. If an activist is going for less than a majority of a company's board, settlement is very important. A victory at the ballot box for an activist just puts their minority slate on the board. That's it. The board then can, with a majority of the board members, form committees and do all the important board work through their major committees and create basically a shadow board. Through a settlement, especially a settlement where the activist has a lot of votes in its favor, the activist can demand for its designees on the board committee designation, where the real work gets done, and they can ensure that they're doing the real work alongside the other board members. And lastly, and more importantly, and most importantly, I believe, expense reimbursement. Shareholders do not like it, and it sometimes is viewed as contrary to Delaware law, for example, where a lot of companies are incorporated, for an activist to join a board with its candidates and then for that newly constituted board to reimburse the activist for its campaign expenses. If an activist settles with the company before a vote at the ballot box, typically there's less blowback from shareholders about the quantum of that settlement. And, you know, oftentimes activists' arrangements with their own investors provide that legal fees and proxy fight expenses come out of the activist's own general partnership budget, which means it comes out of the activist's own pocket. Getting the expense reimbursement, therefore, we find is very important. I'm just going to turn quickly to a few more topics, and then I'll turn it over to Jason. So there are different levels of hostility that we see during the arc of an activism campaign. Initially, the activist will spend many months diligencing an investment, and then they'll start the stake building phase. They'll buy straight equity, they'll buy derivatives, maybe they'll buy with other groups of activist investors. And there are different ways to monitor whether an activist is building a stake in your company. The reporting regimes are delayed and they're not completely accurate, but they're generally there can be antitrust filings, there can be securities filings that certain types of funds with certain types of stakes in a public company have to make. But a lot of stake building happens under the radar. After an activist has established a stake, you hit the engagement phase. And typically, engagement versus private engagement. You get a phone call. You get a private letter. Activist wants to meet with executives, board members. Sometimes they're bumping into board members at cocktail parties or charity events to try to solicit negative statements about the company they can use in their campaign. Where private engagement doesn't permit an activist to achieve the objectives that it is championing for other shareholders, it will move into the public engagement phase. And the public engagement phase ranges from calls, investor phone calls where activists jump into the call and ask questions. Sometimes they plant research analysts onto earning calls to ask questions. That's the most muted type of public engagement. Activists can also make their own public statements. They could issue their own press releases. They could issue public letters to the board, releasing the letter to all shareholders. And lastly, they could issue what we call white papers, which are thought pieces ranging from 15 to 20 slides all the way up to hundreds of slides, as we saw Starboard do in the case of Darden, talking about the quantity of salt in the water in the pot used to make pasta at Olive Garden. Some activists get very granular and pride themselves on extremely detailed and scathing white papers. If public engagement doesn't result in a capitulation by the company or a settlement or the activist going away, then you have a proxy fight. A proxy fight starts with nominations for directors coming in, timely, properly disclosed several months before a company's annual meeting, typically. Director nominations can also come with shareholder proposals for the board to conduct and implement other types of reforms. I mentioned earlier that I used to be a full-time securities litigator, and that does come very handy in the context of shareholder activism campaigns, because there often is litigation. But litigation is normally brought by the shareholder against the company. Shareholders don't like to see companies suing other shareholders. ISS and Glass Lewis, when I mentioned, are very important, also don't like to see it. If a company does have a really good reason to sue a shareholder, our view is sue as quickly as you can and make sure you're going to win that lawsuit. Because if you lose that lawsuit, you've lost in the court of public opinion. And if you bring the lawsuit and it's not abundantly clear that it is a winning lawsuit, you've also lost in the public opinion. Sometimes just suing is a loss in the public opinion for a company altogether. Activists sue to compel shareholder meetings. They sue to access a company's books and records and a shareholder list. They sue to dismantle legal defenses, and they sue to reverse board decisions. However, there is something available to litigators in the context of a proxy fight that is absolutely not available in the context of a litigation in court, and that is ex parte communications with the equivalent of the judge overseeing an activism campaign. That's the SEC examiner. SEC appoints an examiner to oversee every single activist campaign. And we are permitted to reach out to that examiner in writing, confidentially, over the phone, confidentially, to point out every single written statement that the activist has made that violates the federal securities laws or the proxy rules promulgated under the federal securities laws. And the proxy examiner in place by the SEC will then reach out to the activist and say, hey, you need to tone down your rhetoric, or I'm not going to let you solicit votes for this annual meeting. Activists can write the same letters and make the same phone calls to the SEC. They're always made without the other side present. If I were to go into court, or Jason were to go into court and ask the judge for relief without the other side present, I'm sure we're all aware that that's not sanctioned and sanctionable and could result in penalties and disbarment. It's something that's obviously not done in the context of litigation. So there are a few advanced preparation items that I just wanted to gloss over quickly because I know I'm getting a bit short on time here. The best defense for a company means putting the right team together. Obviously, I think I've made clear the role that a law firm plays here, but law firms typically co-lead the defense of a proxy fight, develop strategy, develop legal defenses, briefs the board on fiduciary duties, ensures compliance with the securities laws and state corporate law, review all communications, handles all litigation, drafts all proxy material. An investment bank also typically co-leads, depending on the size of the company and the complexity of the activism campaign, an investment bank will co-lead and assist in developing the issuer's response to the activist's campaign themes. They'll also assist in negotiations. There are specialty public relations firms that have activism response team. They're terrific. They're a part of every campaign. It's very important to have a crisis firm like that on board to draft press releases, write fight letters, make the investor decks that go to ISS and Glass Lewis and other major shareholders. And lastly, and probably most importantly, proxy solicitor. These are the firms that call shareholders, knock on their doors, bump into them wherever they need to bump into them to make sure that they're filling out their voting cards in favor of the company. Or in the case of the activist, make sure they're filling out the voting cards in the case of the activist. In some campaigns, like in Procter & Gamble, companies will hire multiple proxy solicitors to make sure they're covering as much ground as possible. And lastly, on prep, there are a few things that companies should be doing after getting their team together. The first thing the company should be doing is preparing the financial self-evaluation. At least sit down with your law firm and your PR firm and maybe your investment bank and write the five toughest questions that an activist can ask today and figure out what the answer to those questions are. Figure them out in peacetime. Corporate governance analysis. Look at the company's corporate governance through the lens of an activist, through the lens of ISS and Glass Lewis, who are going to be making a determination that can sway your shareholder base. Look at corporate governance through the lens of your major institutional shareholders. Analyze your structural defenses. Companies have bylaws and articles of incorporation. They have other corporate governance guidelines and practices that are adopted. It's best to look at those in peacetime through the lens of an activist. Every word means something different when you're in a proxy fight. Every comma, every period, it takes on a completely different context. There are 20 or 30 items that we typically identify in bylaws and corporate governance practices in peacetime that we tell companies to change that don't cost them any brownie points with their investors, but when they're in a fight, they're glad they have made those changes. Proxy solicitors can also conduct what's called stock surveillance. I mentioned that the securities and antitrust reporting requirements are inadequate. Proxy solicitors have stock surveillance programs. I'm not going to bore everyone with how they work, but a lot of it is art and not science. A lot of it is art and science. Some of it's voodoo. But proxy solicitors can monitor your shareholder base and get a whiff of whether an activist is making a large accumulation and let you know so that you have time to prepare. I mentioned the importance of having a PR firm that has activism experience on board. They can prepare all the standing press releases and talking points and help prep for major meetings with shareholders. They also can conduct shareholder perception surveys so you could figure out whether or not you have an issue while you're in peacetime. And lastly, one thing that V&E does with the advisors that I mentioned before, we sit down with public companies and their boards, and we go through exactly what I just went through over the past 25 minutes to brief them on what they need to know and what they need to be considering in the context of shareholder activism in 2018. But we also take them through a mock proxy fight exercise. I mentioned private engagement, public engagement, proxy fight, settlement earlier. We have hypothetical materials that we put together that we put boards and management through to even better prepare them for the day an activist comes knocking on their door. I'm going to hand it back over to Jason now.
Thanks, Lawrence, very much. And let me say, I personally have done that boot camp that Lawrence was describing, and it's a great exercise and one that can definitely be very advantageous to public companies. So I will talk briefly about several legislative proposals and at least one regulatory proposal that address activism at the federal level. I'll try to keep this pretty brief, though, so that there's time for questions. So let me talk about two legislative proposals first, both of which have been raised in the House, they've gone to committee in the Senate, and they've not advanced beyond committee in the Senate, at least to my knowledge to date. The first is called the Financial Choice Act, which passed the House in June of last year. By way of background, currently a shareholder owning either $2,000 or 1% of a company's outstanding shares that they've held for at least 1 year can put a shareholder proposal up for a vote at a corporate annual meeting. So the Financial Choice Act would eliminate that $2,000 threshold, meaning that a shareholder would need to own at least 1% of a company's outstanding shares to put a proposal up for vote. Obviously, in all cases, that's going to be significantly larger monetarily than $2,000. And the bill would also extend the time frame for holding the stock to 3 years. Now, opponents of the bill say that this would reduce the ability of shareholders to make requests of corporate boards through shareholder proposals or resolutions and might silence small shareholders who sometimes have good ideas, whereas proponents of the bill say that it would prevent a large number of frivolous proposals being made year after year. This really goes to the heart of several of the types of activism that Lawrence was talking about. Now, the bill's heightened ownership threshold would be unlikely to have much impact on the shareholder activism of the sort that Lawrence was discussing, which typically involves institutional shareholders with larger, often substantially larger than 1% ownership stakes. But the extended 3-year ownership period could definitely have some effect because many of the activist hedge funds need or at least want to preserve the ability to basically cut and run. And so they don't necessarily keep their holdings for 3 years. They may not even keep their holdings for 3 years in the majority of cases. So to the extent that a hedge fund strategy involves more than short-term holding periods, involves essentially only short-term holding periods, their ability to engage in activism would definitely be impacted adversely by this bill. But again, it sits in the Senate and has no vote scheduled that I'm aware of. The next piece of legislation in the House is the Corporate Governance Reform and Transparency Act, which passed in December of 2017. And this has also been referred to the Senate, where it sits in committee. This bill deals with proxy advisory firms, and it would such as ISS and Glass Lewis, which Lawrence talked about earlier. This would require them to register with the SEC and would also impose registration and operational requirements on these firms, including, for example, a requirement that they provide accurate, current, and reliable information along with their proxy voting recommendations. They have to have a compliance officer, and they would need to provide financial statements, annual reports, and disclosure of their voting policies. Given their importance, as Lawrence described it, you can see where there might be some sense to this requirement. The bill would also require the SEC to develop regulations that prohibit unfair, coercive, or abusive practices by proxy advisory firms, lots of subjectivity there, and also provide annual reports on the SEC's website regarding its supervision of these companies. And notably, this act, the Financial Choice Act, would also have required proxy advisory firm registration. So this seems to be kind of a hot topic on Capitol Hill. Those who are proponents of the bill, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable, assert that it will help address concerns about the incredible influence that the proxy firms have over public companies in activism campaigns. Opponents of the bill, including the Council of Institutional Investors, which is a trade group whose members include ISS and Glass Lewis, that organization says that the bill would just increase costs for pension plans and other institutional investors who use these proxy firms, because ultimately the firms would just pass along their increased compliance costs. But again, this bill is in the Senate and has no vote scheduled. And as for regulations, there's at least one that's potentially significant that's been floating around Washington since right around the election. In October of 2016, the SEC proposed universal proxy cards. Now, by way of background, under the current rules, as Lawrence alluded to, shareholder voting by proxy in contested board elections must choose from two competing slates of directors on rival ballots. You've got the one that's supported by management and the one that's supported by activists. Shareholders who attend the meeting, however, can vote however they want. They can cast their votes for a mix of directors from both ballots. So in October of 2016, the SEC proposed rules that would mandate the use of so-called universal proxy cards by public companies. Those rules would allow shareholders who vote by proxy to vote for any combination of nominees for board seats, whether they're backed by activists or corporate management, as if they were voting in person. So they could mix and match among the slates. Now, there was a 60-day comment period that wrapped up in January of 2017, and since then, there's really not been any movement on the proposal. But the impact of the proposal on activism, which, as Lawrence noted, often focuses on replacing board members, is somewhat tricky to assess. To the extent that activists usually seek to change only a small number of board members, say less than half, it would seem that they would prefer the universal proxy card, because that would allow shareholders to more easily identify the specific candidates being targeted for replacement and their proposed replacements, presumably increasing the odds of success for at least some of those replacements. And prominent activists like Bill Ackman of Pershing Square and others have publicly called for universal proxy cards for this specific reason, to let shareholders choose the particular directors they prefer rather than having to vote for one slate or another. Based on the composition of the SEC right now, including one Republican commissioner who previously voted against the adoption of these universal proxy cards back in October of 2016, it seems unlikely that this will be adopted by the SEC anytime soon. But again, this is something to be on the lookout for. And last, it actually appears I have a couple of minutes to mention one final item. Also potentially subject to change is the SEC rule regarding what's called Schedule 13D. So currently, the SEC requires investors or groups of investors to publicly report their stakes in a company within 10 days of acquiring a 5% of a public company's shares when they have plans to discuss strategic options for the business, like a sale of the business that an economic activist might undertake. That report is called a Schedule 13D. Now, activists' position is that they need the 10 days, if not more than 10 days, to accumulate their position further, kind of covertly, so they can buy shares at somewhat lower prices that make their campaign active to them in the first place, or attractive to them in the first place. Because once the Schedule 13D is filed, share prices tend to increase. But corporate defense attorneys at several prominent firms, including one of our competitors in New York, as well as a handful of Democratic lawmakers including Senator Elizabeth Warren, have been pushing for a system that shortens the disclosure window. And this is sort of a case of strange bedfellows, since one would expect Senator Warren to be more proactivist than this. But she and other Democrats who have taken the same position would like to see the window condensed to 4 days, meaning disclosure of 5% stake in a public company would need to be made within 4 days of hitting that benchmark as opposed to 10 days. And at least one prominent corporate defense attorney at a different firm has publicly called for the disclosure to even be quicker. And so it'll be interesting to see whether this notion gains any traction with the SEC. Certainly, shortening the disclosure window would be advantageous to companies who'd be more quickly and easily able to identify activists than with the 10-day period. So ultimately, it's possible that some, quote, anti-activist legislation will be enacted, but it doesn't seem imminent, and it seems unlikely in this election year. Likewise, the relatively pro-activist universal proxy card proposal seems to be dead in the water, whereas the possibly anti-activist change in 13D is percolating among thought leaders on Capitol Hill and in New York. And if anything, therefore, I suppose one could conclude that the legal tide is turning incrementally and slowly against shareholder activism, either despite or perhaps because of its rise in recent years. But I would have to say it doesn't seem that this is a purely partisan issue, which is somewhat surprising in our current climate. With that, I will stop, and I think we can see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Jason and Lawrence, for those opening words. Let's go to audience questions. While we're waiting for questions to come in, Lauren and Jason, what would you recommend, or what are the top three mistakes that current companies are making when these activists that we've talked about come knocking on their door, per se?
Jason, it's Lawrence. I'll take that.
Okay.
You can chime in. So there are a lot of mistakes. Off the top of my head, the three things I see companies doing that put them in the worst position possible from a proxy fight perspective are, number one, ignoring the activist. So remember, we've gone over now several times how important ISS and Glass Lewis are in contested director elections. If a company is in front of ISS and Glass Lewis making its case 3 weeks before a contested vote of why the incumbent directors need to stay in place, if the company is that far along in the campaign, they get on the phone with ISS and Glass Lewis. They get in person with ISS and Glass Lewis. I've listened into these phone calls. I've sat in these meetings. The first question that ISS and Glass Lewis will ask is, what is your history of engagement with the activist? If your answer is, oh, well, we ignored the activist for the first 3 months they tried to speak to us, and we didn't talk to them until they issued a public letter, you're not on the track to getting a good recommendation unless your stock price has quadrupled in that particular 1, 3, 5, and 7 year period. So our recommendation is, don't think about whether or not you should be ignoring the activist that's knocking on your door. Think about how the rest of your shareholder base, 95% of the rest of your shareholder base, what do they want to see you doing? You have a fiduciary duty to that activist, even though they're rattling your cage. Talk to them. Listen to them. Prepare to speak to them. Talk with your advisors about how to handle it. We script these initial sessions with activists several times a week. We're doing it. It's like deposition or cross-examination prep, but we do it. It helps build a record of constructive engagement that will help companies in the long run as they deal with potential shareholder activism campaigns. The other recommendations of what not to do dovetail. A board and company should not take defensive measures in haste. There is a time and a place for a poison pill. There are different types of poison pills. We could have three sessions on poison pills. I'd be glad to do it. But they're not right in every single circumstance. It's important when an activist is doing something aggressive, for the board and management to understand the threat, to understand what their fiduciary duties are under whatever state law they're operating under. It's most often Delaware and Nevada, but other states are in the mix too. And the duties vary from state to state, but they also need to consider the effect of the defensive measures they're considering taking in not only court, but in the court of public opinion. Adopting a poison pill doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win votes. Adopting a poison pill means that the activist or group of activists will not be able to buy any more shares or won't be able to buy past a certain threshold of shares. That doesn't mean that they're going to vote for you, and it doesn't mean that your other shareholders are going to vote for you. So defensive measures, therefore, need to be considered very carefully. There's a time and a place for them, but they need to be considered in the context of the entire arc of a campaign, and they need to be done surgically and precisely, and it's important to work with the team of advisors to tell the right story about why they've been adopted. Another issue that we see is where management is tasked with dealing directly with an activist, but they don't update their board. We have found that boards are very concerned about the rising tide of shareholder activism, but they're also more concerned with finding out that their board seats are being targeted by reading it in the Wall Street Journal on a Monday morning when they find out management knew on a Friday afternoon and didn't tell them all weekend. We recommend that for shareholder activism matters that at least an ad hoc group of a few board members, maybe a board chair or a lead independent or a nominating and governance committee member and members of management have a task force to deal with these types of issues so they can make determinations on the fly about who to update and when to update them. No one likes surprises.
You know, I would add to that list just two more, if I may. One, failing to monitor the shareholder base adequately. This is something that can be done relatively easily, and it's important for companies to have people in their investor relations department who do it to be able to try to determine who might become an activist, who's accumulating shares, and whether activists own shares. You can tell from the names on the shareholder list. And, you know, the second, the kind of largest macro one is for a company to assume that it won't happen to them. It's a big mistake for a company to assume that for whatever reason, the industry it's in, its market cap, they're a bunch of good people, that they won't be targeted by activists and therefore to be blind to the risks and necessary preparation. That's a classic mistake that, if made, will often lead to a need to settle on less favorable terms than you might have been able to get had you prepared in advance.
Thank you, Jason and Lawrence. Not seeing any questions lined up, Jason or Lawrence, did you want to offer some closing remarks before we close?
It's Lawrence. Just wanted to thank everyone for giving us the time, and we're both available to answer any questions that may come up or keep you up at night after this call ends.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Jason. Thank you all very much, and you can find either of us if you have any questions or concerns or something you'd like to discuss or have us talk about at greater length. We are delighted to hear from you and to do that.
And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.